Poncho, Enabling Smart Administration of Full Private Clouds, along with Narayan Desai and Lauren Hochstein of Nimbus Services. And basically, with this paper, what we were trying to do is understand kind of what the service model was for private clouds in terms of SLAs or quality of service, and define a better user interaction mechanism between users of private clouds and the operators of those clouds. So a little bit of background, you know, I think everybody here knows that there's a growing use of infrastructure as a service systems in private cloud environments. And this is evidence, you know, lots of people are setting these up for reasons of cost savings versus public clouds, or reasons of just wanting to get something on-premise that they can give to developers to do development that's similar to Amazon or other public cloud environments. And there are already several open source systems on the market. And these systems generally attempt to replicate the APIs offered by Amazon's EC2 API, EC2 services, and the interactions that those things presuppose. We, Narayan, Lauren, and myself operate several medium to large OpenStack systems at Argon and Nimbus. So, you know, as an example, at Argon, we operate a 700 machine system. And operating these systems, we ask ourselves, what's, you know, the best practices for cloud operators, for private cloud operators? And how can we guarantee quality of service? And what should we do in the event of hardware failures that impact user instances and storage and API failures that sometimes happen? And what we learned from asking these questions and looking at how public cloud operators, I should say, you know, we looked at how public cloud operators do this, and you know, Amazon has some support mechanisms. You can obviously send a ticket in if you have a problem. Amazon has an API where they will inform you of planned instance reboots for upgrades in the future, but you have to ask for every instance, and there's no mechanism for them to notify you other than to check an RSS feed or something about system status. So what we realized is that there are distinct differences between operating public and private clouds, and that these differences end up informing how, what policies we should set as private cloud operators and how we should work with users. So how are private clouds different from public clouds? I think the primary difference is that there are greater resource constraints on a private cloud simply because we don't have the economies of scale of Amazon, so we can't field that many machines. And that resource constraint means that you have to be more careful with how you allocate resources. Amazon doesn't care if you spin up, you know, 10,000 VMs. 80% of those will succeed. But in a private cloud, you do care a little bit. And another issue is that, you know, in private environments, you may not have fine-grained pricing models. You may not have a pricing model at all. It may be simply organizational agreements between two different people who gets what resources. And that leads to problems too, because you know you can't incentivize good behavior on the part of users based on price. I mean, you basically have to you adopt then instead of a financial problem, a political problem. And so ultimately, users are in direct contact with operators. They work in the same building or in the same organization, and this has good advantages. I mean, you can coordinate better on upgrades, on you know improving performance, and both groups have like the business interest of the organization to optimally use the machine to better, you know, improve business operations. But additionally, users, you know, we find that users in private clouds tend to be less likely to adopt best practices. And this is, you know, in a science environment, it's because you have scientists and they are wanting to do science. They're not trying to learn what the next cloud methodology is or how to make their, you know, batch code more high available, more highly available. And so, and because operators know more about what users are doing with their systems, they tend to be more faulted when you know problems occur. This is sort of the inverse of ignorance is bliss. You know, we know what instances are typically doing, and so we know what will happen, what the impacts of our operations are. Whereas Amazon can kind of blindly go and operate and you know destroy instances, knowing that well this is sort of the user's fault if something is wrong. And so overall, I think there's a higher expectation of service for private clouds. And this is confounded by you know the resource models and the tools that are given to you in private cloud environments. So as an example, if you look at the OpenStack resource management model, obviously you get basic resources of compute, storage, and networking. And you know, the management of that is set by two different factors. So you have quotas. These set high-level limits on what resources a project or an individual can use. And these are high water marks. So this is the ceiling of how many instances you can launch, how much memory you can use. And you can control requests over placement of instances or storage. So you can do this through various attributes of flavors of instances, host types, hints that you send to the scheduler based on where you want things to go. But ultimately, all the APIs are REST APIs, and when you request an instance, you either have the option of rejecting the request and failing that request, or allowing the instance to be scheduled. And you must make that placement immediately. You can't wait an hour, 2 hours. You can't determine anything based on that. And eventually, once the instance is scheduled, there's no time component there. The instance is expected to run forever until the end of the universe. And that's obviously not realistic in any sense, but it also implies certain problems immediately, which is, you know, you have a limited ability to schedule future work. This is both in terms of scheduling future work that you know you're going to do and scheduling work that might happen in the future but you don't know about yet. And once the system becomes full, all requests are failed, and that makes it completely unusable. And so this incentivizes users to hoard resources. So if I have a feeling that if I give up an instance now because I don't need it now, I don't know that I will be able to get that instance in the future. And additionally, you know, we find generally that all instances tend to trend toward being idle. If it's a batch system, it's, you know, running almost at constant CPU peak, but something goes wrong eventually and that thing stops doing CPU, it stops accepting jobs. If it's an interactive like development system, the user might log in for a day or a week, but then they forget about it, they don't turn it off. So we want to be able to reclaim those, but since we don't know what's going on in the system, the best option is just to complain to the user, and that never really works well. And coming from an HPC background, you know, we typically get 90 to 95% utilization on our HPC systems, and so this looks really bad, and the tools don't really help you with dealing with it. So we kind of looked at what are, you know, the types of instances that, and what are the requirements of users who have different instances in the system. And there's a diverse amount of availability requirements that you have. So this really goes in order of increasing cost of doing any sort of service. That's, you know, scheduling a reboot of the VM or terminating the VM entirely. So for compute-intensive instances or doing batch workloads, generally that's a pretty safe thing. There's not a strict time requirement to have the job done. It can be done in 6 hours. And generally there's queues or task managers that handle rescheduling the job if it failed. The next one is service instances, and these are network accessible services and like web services or something, and they need to respond to requests immediately. Now, luckily, most of the architectures for these use some sort of high availability, whether it's through, you know, EC2's autoscaling or heat or some other you know, API that's been developed by the user. And then you have development instances, and these instances have users that are directly acting on the instance. There's no high availability, obviously, low utilization overall, and most data is luckily in a change control system, but some is unique. And if the instance fails because of a hard drive failure, that data will be lost. And then you have what we call bespoke instances, and these are basically whatever is out there. And so these are typically scientists who are doing really good work, and they have no configuration management, no data backups, and they have long-running applications, sometimes even, you know, days or weeks that they don't back up and they don't checkpoint. And so we really try to identify those very quickly and ensure that they adopt better practices. But that can be difficult when you're in a virtualized environment and you're not aware of what everybody is doing at all times. Obviously, when you operate a big system like this, you need to schedule you need to do service events, whether it's fixing hardware errors or scheduling upgrades, and you know, there's sort of a coordination problem that you have. So in this little example, you've got, you know, 221 servers, which is not very many, you know, 1/4 of our total. And in a given week, you'll have a certain number of disk failures, and those instances are gone. We don't have, you know, high availability storage for the instances, so you need to inform the users of those. You'll have correctable memory errors, and for those, you need to shut down the machine and replace the memory. And you need to let the user know that you're going to shut down the machine. You might have an optic failure. And what this all results in is you might have 30 or more users that you need to contact. And that is a, you know, in a given week, that can be a considerable amount of your time if you don't do it in any automated way, and if you don't have ways of doing it efficiently with, you know, not making your users unhappy. Additionally, you know, you need to make system upgrades, and these might require a reboot if you're upgrading firmware or your operating system kernel, and you need to propagate that across many machines. And you know that there are some machines in here that if you delete every machine, I mean, we're not in a multi-site environment, so you're going to take out some sort of a high availability group and make it unrecoverable. So you want to be able to walk around those, but you don't have the information. And essentially, the problem is that you have this communication gap between what the users know about their systems and what the operators know about the system as a whole. I mean, the user comes in and says, I want to start up an instance, and the operator sees a bunch of instances and has a set of goals that they need to achieve in the next week. And without any sort of communication link between the two of them, you're not able to operate effectively. So we saw this problem, and we wanted to quickly resolve it in some tractable way. And so we decided to write a piece of software and do a very simple set of resource annotations, and this was what Poncho eventually became. And the strategy was basically define a very simple SLA for our users. What we did, what kind of set down, was a 24-hour notification for any sort of planned service. This would be something like replacing memory that was in a faulted state. And so we sent a notification, and in the event that the instance had to be terminated, like the disk failed, we would send a notification saying, hey, this thing failed, just so they knew. And then define a set of annotations that users could apply to their VM, which would allow for a different SLA. And generally, we set, you know, upper bar limits on how restrictive they could make that SLA for us. So a user couldn't say, like, I expect you to notify me a year beforehand. But we really targeted this toward users who could reduce their SLA to something that was more manageable for us and allowed us to have better control over the system. And we wanted to implement this quickly and make it very simple. And so basically there are three components. There's a very simple grammar for annotations, there's a notification library, and there's some tools for administrative operations. So the annotation API is very simple. So these sit on top of OpenStax metadata on instances, which is similar to Amazon's metadata on instances. And there's, you know, one that's a Boolean for saying, you know, I want a snapshot if you're going to terminate this intentionally. There's the notify URL, which gets into the notification system. I'll cover that in a second. The HA group settings there, those specify, they don't actually maintain high availability. All it does is let us know if you're running some sort of HA software, what's the minimum number of machines that you need to have to maintain some sort of parity and system reliability. There's a priority, and this is just an integer that a user sets within a project to indicate that this machine has a higher priority than other machines on the system. Then there's a set of conditional grammars for when you can reboot or terminate an instance. And that grammar basically sets, you know, if we have a min run time, and you can have any combination of these three different conditions. And the min run time basically is there for batch jobs where you know that a job's going to take, you know, 2 hours to run, so don't terminate the instance if it's only been running for an hour. Notified sets a notification limit for doing the operation, and then time of day is for if it's something that needs to be responded to, the user can say, well, don't notify me at, you know, 2 a.m. The notification system is basically, there's the attribute notify URL, and if you set that, we send a HTTP post message to that URL with a JSON body that encodes some of the information based on it. If no URL is supplied, we send an email to the instance owner. We already know that based on previous information. And that email has like a normal body text. It's not just plain JSON. Notifications have some basic attributes, so a description that the operator can write explaining why they're doing what they're doing. And then, you know, event types. So each event type has different sets of notifications. So you can say, you know, for reboot schedule, it tells you when it's going to reboot. And for, you know, snapshot, it'll point you to the snapshot that was created. And this was all put together in a simple little Python program. It already, as I said, it uses the OpenStack APIs for metadata. The client command line tool will validate the grammar before it gets submitted to the server, and it'll kind of explain what the how to write the grammar. The notification library, then there's a library that you use for writing the notifications, and then a set of administrative workflows for doing service events, so shed load requests, or you know, if we have a set of machines we need to shut down and reboot, we can fire that off and it will notify users. Or if we need to shut down or delete a bunch of machines, we can do that. And the code's available on GitHub. And so the results, basically, we had adoption by two projects, mostly for their batch compute workloads. And this was because you know you could automate the annotation. And we saw like less usage for interactive instances. So they got the default SLA, which wasn't necessarily a problem. But I think the issue here is that you know it takes more work to manually annotate an instance that you're using for development or something. And then email invites. So then we found that like you know when you send out you know 20 emails to people, that sort of invites people to say, well, wait, not a second, not me. Mine's special. Like you need to plan around me. And that actually leads to more problems we didn't really anticipate. We anticipated that, but we didn't. The problem is then how do you roll back the operation that you're going to do and reschedule it in a better way? So we needed to add notifications to say, turns out that we've canceled that at last event for the automated users. So future work that we're looking at, obviously we need additional workflows for doing some administrative tasks. One of the things we'd like to do is really codify if we need to make a full upgrade to our entire system, how to do that in an automated fashion. Also, I mean, I think we really need better resource tools in OpenStack in general. So a way of getting time-constrained reservations. So these would be for a particular period, and there's already a project climate that does some of that, but it doesn't allow for a backfill or any sort of batch scheduling notions that we have today. Static reservations, so these are guaranteed instances that a user can, you know, in a project can say, I have 20 instances that I know I can always consume if I need them. And then on-demand spot instances. Obviously, like all this raises the question of how do you do pricing or some sort of fair scheduling within a private cloud environment. And so those are open questions for the future. Another question that you know I'm looking at right now, and these are, you can't really see these, but they're graphs of CPU usage of various VMs, and you can kind of see the breakdown of those four categories I was talking about. And the y-axes are all about equivalent. I think the top of them is 5 gigahertz per minute, I think. I'm not sure exactly. No, per second. I don't know. But you can see that like there's wide diversity in how much resource a particular VM uses, and what we'd like to look at is if you could identify how the behavior of a VM over time and you know optimally pack these VMs in a way that doesn't that effectively does overcommit with no resource penalty for the user running a VM. So that's something I'm looking at right now. And that's basically the end of it. So I'd like to thank you guys for listening and coming here, and I want to thank Narayan and Lauren for my co-authors for helping on the paper and the work they did. And if you have any questions, otherwise the code's on GitHub.
So this is in the nature of a pitch for the paper this afternoon. There's a paper on undo for operators, mm-hmm. and it sounds like if you checkpoint your instances that you want to terminate, then you have the opportunity of undoing the termination?
Yeah, one of the things, that's certainly possible, and we could look at relaunching the instances. One of the things we found is that a lot of times there's state in the VM that's not carefully there's no upstart scripts that if they don't fill out the upstart and do all the right stuff there, and they don't mount the volumes correctly and stuff, they could.
So the undo that's talked about this afternoon deals with those kinds of issues.
Right, certainly, thanks.
Something we did years ago when offering an SLA for schedulability of jobs was that we gave them an SLA, but it said, you must make sure maybe your number of cores is half the number of cores, the average box in the system, just to make it easy. Have you done that, or is it usually not a problem to get them scheduled?
So, the scheduling part in terms of placement is not so much of a problem. Our instance flavors are basically full, half, quarter of the machines, an eighth, in some cases. Mm-hmm. So that tends not to be the problem. The real problem, I mean, there's some fragmentation, but that actually works out pretty well. I guess the problem is really doing a time planning on that.
Right. So if they say, this needs to run next week.
Nobody can do that. I mean, that's the thing. You say, I want it to run now, forever, or never is the problem. So.
Can I follow up a question with a question of the questioner? Like,
sure.
So if you like shut down these VMs, will that like maybe, is there any way that they're talking about resurrecting TCP connections at break and stuff like that, or is that coming up? I mean,
So A, there's a poster downstairs. I don't know what the poster's times are, but B, the answer is that the environment in which the thing is kept is safe. And so when you delete a VM, it's not a real delete, it's a pseudo delete. And so it goes in, it's AWS based, not OpenStack based, but it goes in and intercepts the appropriate calls and does the right thing so that when you get to the point when you want to undo, you have the state as a target.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I'm just wondering about the state on the other side of the machine or connection or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, all the TCP connections.
Oh, you will? Okay, cool. I'll be there. And now for you, if I haven't spoiled your goodwill by talking to this dude instead. So, like, as far as, like, instances that are, you know, just gone foul or whatever, can you, like, migrate those off to, like, like some sort of pasture where they just sort of sit there and don't actually use any CPU time and are maybe way on some hardware that's like way under provisioned and maybe the storage is completely deduplicated to and stuff like that?
We've thought of that model. One of the issues that we have with that is we have iSCSI devices on those instances. And so even if they're not really being used, occasionally they'll have a mount point there and we're not, like transferring that mount point can be tricky. But to go to the previous thing, one thing that we do with volumes, like iSCSI volumes, is when the delete command comes in, we instantly fail that command. So users cannot actually delete volumes in our system. It basically gets marked as deleted, and then we go back a week later and delete it. And we take snapshots of all the volumes over time, because we found that users will often make mistakes. They say, they get their crib sheet, these are biologists, and they say, okay, I have a volume with data on it, so I want to mount it to this VM, so I attach it to the VM, and then I do MKFS, volume, device name, you know, type of file system I want, and then they mount the volume and they say, wait, why is it empty? Because they just blew away everything. So
you said that a lot of these problems come from this communication gap. Have you looked at all at quantifying what those costs are and seeing whether solutions like this reduce those costs?
In terms of quantifying those costs, in terms of hours spent on our part and on the part of like scientists and stuff, I'd say that it's large. I don't know how I would quantify it, but in terms of whether this tool helps, it certainly helps with our issue of scheduling things. I mean, even just the email notifications to users is a lot easier than like, you know, finding the email and then opening something and, you know, sending the email off.
So anecdotally, your users seem happier and you guys are doing less work? Is that?
That's basically it. Yeah, I wish we had better metrics, but we don't at this point.
Right. Do people have more questions, or otherwise I'll ask another one. So there are lots of reasons that you might have a private cloud, and one of the problems you suggested was capacity. So if users want to run something and there's no more room, have you looked at all at spilling over into a public cloud, or are the type of workloads that you guys run not amenable to that sort of thing?
Both, basically. I would say that some of the workloads are not amenable just because you can't find an instance on EC2 that has, I think, a terabyte of memory in some cases. But additionally, we don't have really a cost for that. We can't backbill, and our users are scientists, so they have like fixed funding supplies. So some of them do use EC2, but it's a lot more expensive than doing it in-house in most cases.
All right, let's thank Scott again.
Thank you.